Shalom Hanav Arnix. Welcome to our next class in the Jewish Life of the Messiah, the 2021 edition, where Hanav Arnix Messianic Ministries and the School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. In our Jewish Life of the Messiah class, we're in Lesson 6, and we're in Session 21. So let's review where we were in Session 20. In Session 20, we looked at the changes in the Messiah's ministry as a result of the unpardonable sin. And his ministry changed in four areas. First of all, in signs. Previously, where they were for the nation as a whole, to get them to come to a decision regarding his messiahship. Now, they're going to be for the training of the 12. Secondly, in the area of miracles. Previously, they were for the masses. Again, mass miracles, mass healings, to get the nation to see that he was the Messiah, that he could perform messianic miracles, he was the God-man of the messianic prophecies. And now, however, the miracles are for the individuals. They're for individuals in response to personal need on the basis of faith. Thirdly, in regard to message, previously he was proclaiming that he was the Messiah and he was offering the kingdom. Now the proclamation offer of the kingdom to the nation pauses. And fourthly, in teaching method. Previously, he taught in clear propositional truth, for example, the Sermon on the Mount. But now he teaches in parables to hide the truth from the masses. Again, why parables? Well, there's more than just one reason. The first reason, it's the result of the rejection of his messiahship. Secondly, it's to illustrate the truth for the disciples. Thirdly, it's to hide the truth from the masses. And fourthly, to fulfill prophecy and prove his messiahship. Then we looked at the terms Kingdom of God and Kingdom of Heaven, and we saw that they were synonymous terms. Matthew using Kingdom of Heaven because he was speaking to the Jewish community, and Mark and Luke using Kingdom of God because they were writing to Greeks and Romans who had no convictions about using the name of God. So Matthew uses the substitute, the word heaven. Then we looked at the Kingdom of God or heaven. There are five aspects to the kingdom of God. You know, the kingdom of God is God ruling, but there are five aspects to his rule. The first one is the eternal and universal kingdom. The second was the spiritual kingdom. The third is the theocratic kingdom. The fourth is the messianic or millennial kingdom. And finally, this is the key one, the mystery form of the kingdom, defined as conditions on the earth during the king's absence. And this is what is explained in the parables, Matthew 13 and Luke 8. This is what is described in the parables. Now, the key to interpretation of the parables is Mark 4:13. And he said to them, "Do you not understand this parable? How will you understand all the parables?" And the reference, this parable, is the first parable. If you don't understand the first parable, how will you understand the rest? And there's a lot of detail given in the first parable, not so much detail given in the rest. So this is the key to interpreting the parables and all that they mean. So here's a summary of the parables of the kingdom. The aspect covered is the mystery form of the kingdom. The time frame is the current age between the first and second coming. And the theme is the course of the kingdom during the current age. What's going to happen? So we start with the public parables. We start with number one, the parable of the soils. This is the age will be characterized by the sowing of the gospel seed, but with limited response. And so evangelism will characterize the age, evangelism. But there'll be a limited response. Secondly, the seed growing of itself. The seed, the gospel seed, we learned that the seed was the gospel in the first parable. The gospel seed has an inner energy. It will spring to life of its own accord. And this is the power of regeneration. We really can't explain it, but this simple gospel message, when believed and appropriated, changes your eternal destiny. Third, we come to the parable of the tares. There will be false counter-sowing during the kingdom, so there'll be opposition. Fourthly, the parable of the mustard seed. The kingdom will grow to huge outer proportions and experience direct attack by Satan's agents. So there'll be growth of the kingdom, but there will also be persecution against the kingdom. Fifthly, the parable of the leaven, there will be inward doctrinal error. So error and disunity will be introduced into the kingdom due to the persecution and opposition that the kingdom constantly has to endure. Then we move to the private parables, the parable of the hidden treasure, which speaks of Israel. Nevertheless, in spite of all the hassle, in spite of all the tsuris, Jewish people will be saved. And then the pearl, the parable of the pearl, which speaks of the Gentiles. Nevertheless, in spite of all the tsuris, all the trouble, the Gentiles will be saved as well. Then we come to the eighth parable, the dragnet. The age will end with the judgment of the Gentiles, the unrighteous excluded and the righteous taken in. And this is the conclusion of the age. Now we say the judgment of the Gentiles because we know from Romans that all Israel will be saved at the end of the tribulation period. So only Gentiles will be judged to enter into the Messianic kingdom or be excluded from it. And then we come to the parable of the householder. This is a summary parable. Some aspects of the mystery kingdom are old and some are new. And so, for example, Israel, the treasure, is an old aspect. An old aspect is Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. A new aspect is the Brit HaDeshah, for example. All right, this brings us to the new material. And we're going to pick up the lesson on section 93, the departure across the sea and the calming of the storm. We're in lesson 6, page 13, at the top of the page, if you've downloaded your outline. Now we're going to see Yeshua's power over nature. So new miracles follow the rejection of his messiahship. Again, the miracles are only to teach the disciples. They are no longer signs to the nation as a whole. The nation has reached its decision regarding him. Now the timing is Mark 4:35. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, "Let's go over to the other side." So it's the same day, just later in the day, in the evening, the same day he was rejected, the same day that he taught the parables. And suddenly they find themselves in a serious situation, Mark 4:6-37. After dismissing the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a fierce gale of wind developed, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling with water. All right, we see this is a very critical situation, and this fierce gale suddenly erupting over the Sea of Galilee can happen in moments, can happen in very short time in the Sea of Galilee. How come? Why does that happen? Well, because there are three valleys that funnel Mediterranean air down into the Sea of Galilee in the evening, especially. This cool air drops down into the low Sea of Galilee. We have the Beit HaKerem Valley and the winds coming from the Beit HaKerem Valley. And then we have the Beit Netufa Valley, and that funnels winds on down as well. And finally, the Turan Valley. Three valleys directing their wind to the surface of the Sea of Galilee. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, we've also got Mount Hermon on the east side, and so cold winds can slide down the flank of Mount Hermon and hit the Sea of Galilee as well. And here is an illustration of the disciples in the boat. You see 3-foot waves. There's just small boats, so it's swamping the boat. And they're in very, very serious danger. Now here's the Sea of Galilee that I chose to show this picture because it duplicates what I did one year. One year I was in a kibbutz. I was on a tour group and we were staying in a kibbutz on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. So after dinner, it was evening and it was very pleasant out. There was nothing to do. So I walked out on the beach of the Sea of Galilee and looked west, and you can see the Arbel way off in the distance there. And it was a beautiful, placid lake, But then, suddenly, these winds showed up. And in a half hour, 3-foot waves, just like these pictured here, 3-foot waves were crashing into the shore at my feet. So I've witnessed the Sea of Galilee get stirred up in a very, very short time. So they are in great danger. That's because they're not in a huge ocean-going boat. Here's the kind of boat they're in. This is a fragment of a mosaic found at Magdala that depicts a fishing boat in the first century. And there is our fishing boat right there. It had sails, it had two oars on each side, and a steering oar to the right beneath the high stern, and a crew of five. So four men paddling and one man steering. And here's a close-up of that particular mosaic, the Magdala fishing boat. Now, another fishing boat, a real fishing boat, was discovered a number of years back, hidden in the mud of the Sea of Galilee. And archaeologists got busy on it and were able to pull it out of the mud and preserve it. And the story of the Sea of Galilee boat is found in a book by that name, by Shelley Waksman. If you're interested in biblical archaeology or archaeology of the period, this would be a very interesting book for you to read. Here's a picture and caption from the book. A boat recovered in 1986 from the Galilee lake bed, shown here as it was gently lifted from the lake, ensconced in a protective shell of polyurethane. That's what was needed to safely remove it from the mud and get it up on the shore. Now here's a picture of the front part of that polyurethane shell that was used to bring the Galilee boat onto shore. And then it was put in a vat for chemical preservation. I believe they exchanged the water with plastic, some kind of fluid plastic. And so the boat had to stay in this chemical soup for quite a while so that the water would be driven out of the wood and the wood would not continue to deteriorate. But the wait was worth it, and now the Galilee boat is on display at Kibbutz Ginosar, and you can go and observe it. It's quite an amazing sight to see the remains of this 2,000-year-old boat. Now here's a drawing of how they think the boat looked when it was in its heyday. And there's a model there also at the Ein Gev Museum of the Galilee boat. Very small little boat, but has nice lines to it though, doesn't it? So there's the Galilee boat. And there is a replica of Galilee fishing boats at Ein Gev, Kibbutz Ein Gev as well. I think it is full size or close to full size. And if you get to Kibbutz Ein Gev, you can visit this replica and get a look at a full size, or pretty much a full size boat of the period. All right, so that's what they were in, and they were in danger because this is no great big sailing vessel and the waters are swamping the boat. Now, what's the purpose? Why did Jesus bring them out into the middle of the lake in order to swamp them, bring them in great danger? Well, let's take a look at Mark 4, 38 through 40. And yet Yeshua himself was in the stern, asleep on a cushion, on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And so he was in the boat, in the stern of the boat. And here's the Galilee model, of course. He's on a cushion, sleeping in the back of the boat. And the water's sloshing in. And when they plead with him, he rebukes the winds. Now, the Greek term literally says he muzzled the winds. It's portraying the winds like a wild animal attacking the boat. And he now makes this wild animal harmless. And notice, he describes them as timid. The Greek word means even afraid or cowards. He expects them to be brave, even braver than they already are, through faith in God. These are seasoned, brave fishermen. So the lesson for us and for them, don't depend on your own human courage. Exceed your human courage through faith in me. Now let's move. Oh, and this is exactly what he said to Joshua as well. Joshua received this kind of an exhortation. "Be strong and courageous," God says in Joshua 1, 6 through 9. "Only be strong and very courageous. Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." So he expects us to exceed our human courage because we're trusting him and he's at our side. All right, let's move on to Matthew 8:27. The men were amazed and said, "What kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Now remember, a number of these disciples were experienced fishermen, and they had gone through storms on the Sea of Galilee. But when the wind calmed, normally the sea did not. The sea continued to churn back and forth and up and down for a while before it slowly settled into a smooth surface. But here, in this experience, not only did the wind stop, but the sea calmed as well. And this is very, very, very different. And his power is very obvious. And so they're a bit afraid of him, too. It's more frightening to have God in the boat than to have the storm outside the boat. So Jesus has just become their leader in the area of courage. Now, do you think these verses may have come to their minds as they went through this terrifying experience? Psalm 89, 8 and 9. O Lord God of hosts, who is like you, O mighty Lord? Your faithfulness also surrounds you. You rule the swelling of the seas. When the waves rise, you still them. God stills the waves. Psalm 65, 5 through 7. By awesome deeds you answer us in righteousness, O God of our salvation. You are the trust of all the ends of the earth, and from the far of the sea, who established the mountains by his strength, being girded with might. Who stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, and the tumult of the peoples. God stills the waves. Psalm 135:8. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does, in heaven and on earth, in the seas and the deep. So he's the master of the land masses. He's the master of the ocean and the water as well. Psalm 107:23-30. Those who go down to the sea in ships, who do business on great waters, they have seen the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he has spoken and raised the stormy wind, which lifted the waves of the sea. And now here's their experience of this storm. They rose up into the heavens, and they went down into the depths. So what big waves those were. Their soul melted away in their misery. They reeled and staggered like a drunken person. They were at their wit's end. This is a big storm. And what is their reaction? Their action's the correct reaction. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distresses. He caused the storm to be still so that the waves of the sea were hushed. And then they were glad because they were quiet, and he guided them to the desired harbor. God calms the waters. This miracle is a claim to deity. Yeshua is calming the waters. Yeshua is doing something only God can do. He is the God-man of the messianic prophecies. All right, now we're at lesson 6, page 15 at the top of your page. He's told them, have courage. Have courage. Well, they're going to need some courage to face this next incident. We come to the healing of the Gerasene demoniac and the resultant opposition. Matthew 8, Mark 5, Luke 8. Now we're going to look at power over demons. We just saw power over nature. Now we're going to see power over demons. Now, this is the first detailed description of a demonized state. Up to now, we've only been told such and such had a demon. Now we see what that looks like. So the description comes in Mark 5, verses 1 through 5. They came to the other side of the sea, into the region of the Gerasenes. When he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, not even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, night and day, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains, and cutting himself with stones. Folks, I would be terrified of this guy. I think God's presence, Yeshua's presence, brought some courage into the disciples' hearts. Well, this is the first detailed description of demonization. Why the description now? Well, it's because the one accused of being demonized, Yeshua, that's the basis of his rejection, the one accused of being demonized now is face to face with one who is an actual extreme example, an actual extreme case of being demonized. Now, Messiah is going to bind the Lord of the false kingdom. If Yeshua had been demonized by Beelzebul, he would have behaved in this very same manner. But he doesn't behave that way. Now, the location of this miracle takes place in Gadara, which is a region on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, near the city of Gergesa, which is a city in the region. And we really don't know where this city is located, but we have some possibilities, a couple of possibilities. Here's your Sea of Galilee. Capernaum is where they left. They were up at Capernaum. They left Capernaum. And here's Gadara. Gadara is the region to the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And the primary location for this miracle is probably the place called Kirsi or Gergesa on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Kirsi, Gergesa. So they leave Capernaum, they get out in the middle of the lake, and the storm comes and blows them all over the place, and Yeshua calms the storm, and they finish up their trip to Kirsi, Gergesa. Now here is a Byzantine-era church at Kirsi Gergesa. That's because this area was venerated as the location of this miracle very, very early. So that's one indication that it might be the best place to consider the location. But the most important thing to note is that this is Gentile territory, whether it's here or some other nearby area. This is Gentile territory. Now, the demonic immediately recognizes Yeshua. And here we get a glimpse of demonic knowledge. Lesson 6, page 17 at the top of the page. We'll pick it up on Matthew 8, 28 and 29. And when he came down to the other side of the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men confronted him as they were coming out of the tombs. They were so extremely violent that no one could pass by that way. And they cried out, saying, "What business do you have with us, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now, two demons meet them, according to Matthew, two demoniacs. The Mark account focuses on the primary demoniac, but Matthew includes both. He wants us to know that two of them were involved, even though one was the main subject of the miracle. Now, what do demons know? What's demonic knowledge? Well, first of all, they know who Jesus is. He's the Son of God. And their own doom. Have you come here to torment us, Son of God? Jesus uses the Jewish method of exorcism at this point. He asks the name of the demons. This is Mark 5:9. And he was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Now, a Roman legion consisted of between 3,000 and 6,000 soldiers. So there's a minimum of 3,000 demons in this man. He is extremely demonized. That's why his behavior is so incredible. Now we come to the subject of the abyss. This is lesson 6, page 17, in the middle of the page there, Luke 8:31. And they were begging him not to command them to go away into the abyss. All right, what's the abyss? Well, the abyss is a temporary place of confinement for fallen angels. We see it in Revelation 20, 1 through 3. And he, this is an angel, threw him, this is Satan, into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. So the abyss is a temporary place of confinement for fallen angels. Some are there now and will be released later. Some will be sent there now and confined. But they ask, instead of being sent into the abyss, to be sent into a herd of swine, some 2,000 in number. We'll learn that number in just a moment. And so Yeshua grants them permission, Mark 5:11 through 13. Now there was a large herd of pigs feeding nearby on the mountain. And the demons begged him, saying, "Send us into the pigs so that we may enter them." And Yeshua gave them permission, and coming out, the unclean spirits entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. So first of all, permission is granted. Who's in charge? What does that tell us? Who's in charge? Yeshua again proves to the disciples that he dominates the powers of hell. The powers of darkness do not dominate him. He's not demonized. He's the strong man. He's the strong man. Now, these pigs then commit mass suicide by running down the slope into the lake. Now, could this possibly be the slope? This is the Kursi Gergasa harbor, and you see there is a slope running down right into the lake itself. And this apparently is the only area that has an adequate topography for this miracle. There is a slope going down directly into the Sea of Galilee. And here's another look at the cliff at Kursi Gergesa. Yes, that could that be the slope the pigs ran down, right down into the sea? That sure could be, couldn't it? Well, there's an alternate site, an alternate location from Kursi Gergesa, and others feel that the site is Hippos. And here is Hippos, or also known as Susita, and it's very easy to spot as you look across the Sea of Galilee because of the distinctive mountain sticking up there. So that mountain does provide a slope, but it doesn't go down directly into the sea. So this doesn't seem to be the best site for the miracle. Now, another question we have to answer is, why did Jesus give permission? Well, the common answer by a lot of commentators is, because owning pigs is not permitted under the Mosaic law, so he allowed unclean spirits to enter unclean pigs. Well, that's not true, because this is Gentile territory. Gentiles can own and eat pigs. So the answer, we don't know. We don't know why he gave permission. It is never stated, and we have to be satisfied with that. However, we can observe the responses to the miracle. This is lesson 6, page 18 at the top. We begin with the herdsman's response. This is found in verses 14 through 17, Mark 5. Their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and in the countryside, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. So the curious crowd gathers, and then they came to Yeshua and saw the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had previously had the legion. They became frightened. Those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the pigs. They began to beg him to leave their region. So the pig owners report on the event to the surrounding region, and the inhabitants are struck with fear, and they ask Yeshua to leave. So that's the response of the herdsmen and the inhabitants of the area of Gergesa. And now we come to the response of the demonized man in verses 18 through 20. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was begging him that he might accompany him. And he did not let him. But he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Yeshua had done for him, and everyone was amazed. So Yeshua says no when the formerly demonized man wants to become a disciple. Well, why that? That seems weird also. Well, it's because he is a Gentile. At this point, the way is not open to the Gentiles. Rather, he is to witness about Yeshua. So the policy of silence applies only to the Jews, not to the Gentiles. He can't become a disciple yet and go into Jewish territory and proclaim the Messiahship of Yeshua to the Jews. Jesus and his disciples are going to do that. But he can become a witness in the Decapolis to the Gentile people that are living in the Decapolis. And here's a map of the area. Now, the Decapolis right here is a confederation of 10 Gentile cities. And so our demonized friend goes into the Decapolis and begins a ministry witnessing for Yeshua, and we'll see the results of his ministry later on in the study. Now, in your notes, there's an article about the Decapolis, lesson 6, page 18. And by the way, here's another important point. This incident is the only known reference in the Bible to deviled ham. Told you it was important. All right, now we're in lesson 6, page 19 at the top of the page. Section 95, the return to Galilee. the healing of the woman who touched Messiah's garment, and the healing of Jairus' daughter. We've seen the power over nature. We've seen his power over demons. Now we witness his power over disease and death. Now, for the disciples, the lesson will be regarding Yeshua's power. This is lesson number one. Jesus is going to drive home the lesson that his miracles are on the basis of faith in response to personal need to individuals. For the woman and Jairus, the lesson is exercising faith and trust in him, depending on him in faith. That's lesson number two. So let's pick it up on Mark 5, 21 and 22. When Yeshua had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him. So he once more is in Jewish territory now. And he stayed by the seashore. And one of the synagogue officials, that's proof that's Jewish territory, isn't it? And one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came and upon seeing him fell at his feet. Well, the location of this miracle is unknown. Here's a map of the Sea of Galilee. Now they're in the area of a Cursi Gergesa, and they go across to the other side, the Jewish territory, but there's all kinds of little Jewish fishing villages dotting the edge of the Sea of Galilee. So it doesn't say to which of these fishing villages Yeshua and the disciples sailed. Okay, so the best thing we can say, the location is unknown, just a fishing village on the beach of the Sea of Galilee. Now, this fellow Jairus, he is a ruler of the synagogue. He is a respected leader of the community. And here we see a respected leader of the community showing this rejected, demon-possessed, counterfeit Messiah great respect. He fell at his feet. He fell at his feet. All right, Mark 5, 23. And pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter's at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her, that she may get well and live." And he went off with him, and the large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. So the daughter is sick. Yeshua responds in compassion, and he moves out to go to Jairus' home. But an incident interrupts his journey. This is Matthew 9:20. And behold, a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years came up behind him and touched the border of his cloak. All right, this woman wants to touch his tzitzit. Now, what is a tzitzit? Well, the tzitzit is the fringe on his garment. And these fringes were commanded by Numbers 15 and Deuteronomy 22:12. Numbers 15 reads, "Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue." And then in Deuteronomy 22:12, "You shall make for yourself tassels on the four corners of your garment with which you cover yourself." All right, now this is a prayer shawl or a tallit, and its fringes, which are the tzitzit. And the tzitzit are these particular long fringes in the corners of the tallit. And the other fringes are simply decorative. It's these key that are important. You see, the prayer shawl started out just as a all-weather shawl. It was just a shawl to put over your body to shed the rain and keep out the wind and all that kind of stuff. But as styles changed and the shawl was being used less and less, the rabbis converted it into a prayer shawl. And so now Jewish men have prayer shawls that they can wear in the synagogue with the tzitzit attached to them. Now here we have a white tzitzit, and you notice that it was said that it should have a line of blue, a blue thread in it. Well, the rabbis have not allowed that for many years because they're afraid of using the wrong shade of blue. Anyway, this tzitzit has a traditional tying pattern. For example, 2 knots, 7 coils, 2 knots, 8 coils, 2 knots, 11 coils, 2 knots, 13 coils, and then 2 knots. The numbers 7 and 8 equals 15, and that's the numbers of the letters Yod and He. These are the first two letters of the name of God. And then 11 is equivalent to Vav and He, the last two letters of the name of God, thus equivalent to Yahweh, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the name of God. Now, 13 is equivalent to the Hebrew word echad, aleph, chet, dalet, which means one. And so the meaning of the tzitzit is to look at the tzitzit, is to remember and know that God is one. That's the symbolism there. And here is a tzitzit with the biblical cord of blue in it. Some rabbis feel that the correct shade of blue has been discovered, and so they put them in their tzitzit kits. So you can have the biblical cord of blue. And here's men at the Western Wall wearing their prayer shawls. And of course, the prayer shawls have the tzitzit at the corners of the shawls. And now these two young men are wearing talit katan with their fringes, with their tzitzit. And the talit katan is a small talit that's worn under the clothes, so you can have a prayer shawl on all day. And then the tzitzit hang down from underneath the clothes. And you can see the tzitzit on these two men. And so this is a talit katan with fringes with the tzitzit. And here is a talit with, well, the two types of talit, the large prayer shawl talit and the katan, talit katan, the little small one that's worn over the shoulders. All right. Now, this woman wants to touch his tzitzit. Well, why? Well, that's probably based on Malachi 4:2. For you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you shall go forth and frolic like calves from the stall. Well, the corners of the talit were called the wings of the talit. And so here, she's probably associating healing in its wings with the wings of the talit. So she wants to touch this talit and receive healing. And she does. She touches it and she receives healing. Now, here we get a glimpse into the personalities of the writers. God did not violate the personalities of his human writers. And we start with Mark. Mark is not a doctor, and so he's not very sympathetic to doctors, so he sounds rather hostile in this explanation. Mark 5:26, the woman had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all she had and was not helped at all, but instead had become worse. Kind of a negative view of doctors. Now, Luke is a doctor, and he's sympathetic. So he acknowledges the problem, but he gives the benefit of doubt to the doctors. He says, and a woman who had suffered a chronic flow of blood for 12 years and could not be healed by anyone. No one could do the job, even if you were a doctor. All right, so let's move back to Mark 5:23, where the healing occurs. And immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body she was healed of her disease. So then Yeshua stops, and he asks for her in order to teach the disciples a lesson about his power. He is now graciously using his power on the basis of faith in response to personal need for individuals. Verses 30 through 32. And immediately Yeshua, perceiving in himself that power had gone out, turned around to the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. Now, this is not a question of ignorance, as verse 32 shows us here. He does know who touched him. But he wants to draw the attention of the disciples so they will learn the lesson from this. He's teaching them that he exercises his power on the basis of faith in response to personal need. So the miracle's for their benefit as well. So let's pick it up at Luke 8:45 and 46. And Yeshua said, "Who is the one who touched me?" And while they were all denying it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing in on you." But Yeshua said, "Someone did touch me, for I was aware that power had left me." Now, can you picture him pointing to Peter, his disciple, his student, and saying to him, "You, who touched me? Peter, who touched me?" Peter's attention is caught. He's somewhat exasperated. "Many, many touched you. How can I tell who touched you? A whole bunch of people did. They're banging into you." Yeshua said, "A specific one touched me, the one with the touch of faith." And now we come to the lesson for the woman. Lesson 6, page 20 at the top of the page, Luke 8:47 and 48. Now, when the woman saw that she had not escaped notice, She came trembling and fell down before him and admitted in the presence of all the people the reason why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." Now this woman is afraid because she was in a state of ritual impurity because of her hemorrhaging. Normally the touch of the impure defiles the pure, but in this case, the exact opposite happened. Healing is transferred, not infection, not uncleanliness. Matthew 9:22. But Yeshua, turning and seeing her, said, "Daughter, take courage, your faith has made you well." And at once the woman was made well. Now, in Matthew's condensed brief account, he corrects her theology. It is her faith, not her touch, that saved her and healed her. The power came from him, not the clothing. There's nothing superstitious here. You know, mankind, tend to revere objects. Revering objects is idol worship. There is no power in objects. There is no power in his clothing. The power is in Yeshua himself. So now we come to the lesson for Jairus, Mark 5:35. While he was still speaking, people came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter has died. Why bother the teacher further?" So the daughter dies, and Jairus observes all this, and he has a lesson to learn, Mark 5:36. But Yeshua, overhearing what was spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid, only believe." So as the woman trusted Yeshua, so Jairus has to trust Yeshua. The lesson, Yeshua exercises his power on the basis of faith in response to personal need. Verse 37, and he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. So the policy of privacy is going to be followed. This is not for the masses. This is for individuals. So this miracle will be performed on the basis of faith in response to personal need. So only these disciples are allowed to proceed with the immediate family. Peter, James, and John are his inner circle. So now we come to Mark 5:38 and 39. And they came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion, and people loudly weeping and wailing. And after entering, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child has not died, but is asleep." Now this commotion was made by the professional mourners, and we learn that in Matthew 9:23. When Yeshua came into the official's house and saw the flute players and the crowd in noisy disorder. Well, having professional mourners was very much part of the Jewish culture in the Middle East. This is an illustration of professional mourners as they lead the procession, taking this person in the coffin there to the grave. We learn about professional mourners in Amos 5:16. "Therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts, the Lord, there is wailing in the plazas and all the streets. They say, alas, alas." And they also call the farmer to mourning and professional mourners to lamentation. And then in Jeremiah 9:17 and 18, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, consider and call for the mourning women that they may come, and send for the wailing women that they may come. Let them make haste and take up a wailing for us, that our eyes may shed tears and our eyelids flow with water." So that's the purpose of the commotion there by the professional mourners, to raise a commotion, raise a command, all kinds of noise and sorrow, get people's tears to flow, all that kind of stuff. Do a good job of mourning, moaning and groaning. Well, anyway, at his command, the resurrection occurs, Mark 5:40-42. And they began laughing at him, but putting them all aside, outside, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was in bed. And taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old. And immediately they were completely astonished. So at his command, then, the resurrection occurs just that suddenly. And now she wasn't swooning, because if she was swooning, she wouldn't be able to just jump right up and eat. She'd gradually get out of bed and get her head on straight. Or if she was in some kind of a coma, she wouldn't just bounce out of that and bounce out and start walking around. See, she was dead and she was resurrected. All right, this is not some kind of a coma that she came out of. All right, Mark 5:43, and he gave them strict orders that no one was to know about this, and he told them to have something given her to eat. So the new policy is followed, a policy of privacy and silence. This resurrection is not for the nation to see. Luke 8:56, her parents were amazed, but he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. Now, wouldn't you find that to be hard? You know, you've called the professional mourners, they've arrived, they're doing the job, they've seen the corpse, they know the child is dead, and they're very familiar with death. They're so certain that she's dead that they laugh at him when he says she's sleeping. They know what a dead person looks like. Then all of a sudden your daughter walks out of the room totally healthy and hungry. What would be the first question they would ask? What happened? What happened? Oh, wouldn't it be hard to say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Boy, good for those parents. They seem to have held their peace. Now, I am also totally sure that this girl was dead and that they knew it because of an incident that happened in my life. I'm totally sure that they knew she was dead. Many years ago, my father died of a heart attack. And so I was called over to the apartment, my mom and dad's apartment, and I walked into the room where his body lay, and his entire body was covered with a sheet. Except for his hand. His hand protruded out from under the sheet. And when I saw that hand, I instantly knew it was a dead hand. It was blue. I knew he was no longer alive. And these people were very familiar with death. They knew this girl had died. No doubt. No coma, no fainting, nothing like that. This is a resurrection. All right, lesson 6, page 21 at the top, section 96. Three miracles of healing and another blasphemous accusation. Matthew 9:27. And Yeshua went on from there. Two men who were blind followed him, crying out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." And now we get another look at his power. This time it's power over blindness. Now the basis of the request, number one, is the Son of David. The two blind men put forward the request on that basis. They're asking on the basis of his messianic office, which has been rejected. It's been rejected. But it's interesting to see that the blind can see who he is. Too bad the sighted couldn't. Anyway, the blind know who he is. So the answer on the basis of his messianic office is no. And so he ignores them. Verse 28 and 29. And after he entered the house, the men who were blind came up to him, and Yeshua said to them, so they persisted, didn't they? Do you believe that I'm able to do this? And they said to him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes and saying, it shall be done to you according to your faith. So the basis of request number two, the second request they made, faith and personal need. And then so Yeshua asks a question to elicit that faith, you know. He needs them to express their trust. Yes, Lord. Now, on the basis of his messianic office, no. But on the basis of faith and personal need, yes. And so now the policy in verses 30 and 31. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, saying, see that no one knows about this. But they went out and spread the news about him throughout the land. So they disappear. They disobey this very stern warning. But he repeats this policy of silence for the Jewish community. And now as we get to verses 32 and 33, we come to another miracle. And as they were going out, behold, a demon-possessed man who was unable to speak was brought to him. And after the demon was cast out, the man who was previously unable to speak talked. And the crowds were amazed and were saying, nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel. So here's a repeat of the messianic miracle, the casting out of a demon of muteness, the kind of demon the rabbis could not heal, but the kind of demon the rabbis said the Messiah would heal when he came. But what is the response of the rabbis, of the Pharisees? Verse 34, but the Pharisees were saying, he casts out demons by the ruler of the demons. So they're still voicing the same basis for rejecting him, demonization. In spite of the fact that he's not acting like a demonized man. He's not acting like the guys over there in Gergesa. In spite of the fact that he's opposing Satan, he's defeating Satan, casting out the demons. And in spite of the fact that he's performing messianic miracles, miracles that they themselves taught only the Messiah could perform. This is stubbornness. This is stubbornness. All right. Now we're at lesson 6, page 22 at the top of the page. And we're in section 97, which is the final visit to unbelieving Nazareth. Matthew 13 and Mark 6. So let's take a quick look at the map. The final rejection in Nazareth. Yeshua is somewhere on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. So he leaves that little fishing village, wherever it is, and heads for Nazareth. There is Nazareth right there in Upper Galilee. So he has to make the trek uphill from the Sea of Galilee up to Nazareth. And now he faces his final rejection. Because what happens in Nazareth is representative of the nation. There was an initial rejection in Nazareth. And now will come the final rejection in Nazareth. There was also initial rejection, by the nation in Matthew chapter 12. And there will come a final rejection by the nation as well. Now we learn a bit about Yeshua's family from Matthew and Mark here. We learn that his guardian, Joseph, was a carpenter, Matthew 13, 54 and 55. And he came to his hometown, that's Nazareth, and began teaching them in their synagogue, with the result that they were astonished and said, where did this man acquire his wisdom and these miraculous powers? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is his mother not called Mary and his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas? So they call him the carpenter's son, Joseph's son. That is the common misconception of the day. And Matthew dealt with it in his genealogy way back when at the beginning of our study. Yeshua is not Joseph's son. No way, no how. He is the Son of God. He's the Son of God. We also learn that Jesus was a carpenter in the Mark account, verse 3. Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And are his sisters not here with us? And they took offense at him. So you see, he is called the carpenter because that would have been the skill that he had learned from Joseph, that had been passed on from Joseph. And some apparently understand that Joseph is not his father. They don't call him the carpenter's son. They call him the carpenter. Now we see here that Yeshua had four half-brothers. That means they had the same mother, but a different father. Yeshua's father was God. The James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, their father was Joseph. Now, so he has four half-brothers, and none will be believers until the resurrection, till he is resurrected from the dead. And we see that he had a minimum of two half-sisters. Again, same mother. Mary was the mother of the sisters and of Yeshua, but a different father. Yeshua's father was God. The girl's sister was Joseph. So Mary apparently did not remain a virgin as the Roman Catholic Church teaches. I believe they teach the perpetual virginity of Miriam. And they say, and that we see here that she had six other kids by Joseph, at least six other kids. Now the final rejection is recorded in verses 57 and 58 of the Matthew account. And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not dishonored except in his homeland and in his own household. And he did not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. So he only does a few miracles. Why? The miracles are being done now on the basis of faith in response to personal need. So there was a few there in Nazareth who had the faith, because he could not do a lot of miracles, but he did some then. There were a few, a remnant, who believed in him. Now, it's fascinating to me that there is a rabbinic doctrine that the Messiah will not have a father, a human father. And we get this from the suffering servant of Isaiah, according to Jewish interpreters. The book might still be available on Wiff and Stock, I believe, is where I got my copy. The suffering servant of Isaiah, page 33. The Breshit Rabbah of Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, in the middle of the 11th century. He speaks of Rabbi Berechiah, who's a 3rd century rabbi. The Holy One said to Israel, "You have spoken before me, saying, we are orphans and have no father." Here's the response. "The Redeemer, whom I shall raise up out of your midst, will have no father also. As it is said, behold, the man whose name is the branch, and he shall branch up out of his place," Zechariah 6:12. And similarly by Isaiah, "and he come up as a sucker before him." Now the common denominator here is that these branches come out of one source, out of the tree, one source, not two sources, as human beings do. And that's the point here, is that the Redeemer will only have one source. He won't have a human father. He does have a human mother, but not a human father. And so the Redeemer will have no human father also. And this is fully in accord with Isaiah 7:14. "Wherefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and she will name him Emmanuel." See, the virgin. There will only be one human source for Yeshua's body. God will be the second source. So he will have no human father. He will have no human father. And this is brought up in the New Testament, of course, in Matthew 1:22 through 25. "Now all this took place so that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet would be fulfilled. Behold, the virgin will conceive." In her virginity, she would conceive. She would not conceive human seed. She would not be impregnated by Joseph. In her virginity, she will conceive and give birth to a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. So this is also fully in accord with the genealogies that we have seen in Scripture as well. "Joseph awoke from his sleep and did as the angel of the Lord commanded him, and took Mary as his wife and kept her a virgin till she gave birth to a son, and she named him Yeshua." So they are fully in accord with the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14. I'm out of time now. I see I've been at this for an hour. So I'm just going to say Lehit Ra'ot. So glad you joined us for these lessons. We'll see you next session as we pick it up on section 99. Lehit Ra'ot. Lehit Ra'ot.